Hey, it's Nancy. Before we begin today, I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to Crime Beat early and ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
The following episode contains descriptions of sexual violence and may not be suitable for everyone. It also contains coarse language, adult themes, and content of a violent and disturbing nature. Listener discretion is advised.
In January 1980, 5-year-old Kimberly Thompson walked to kindergarten by herself for the very first time. But she never made it to class that day. And when she didn't come home for lunch, her mother, Evelyn, panicked.
And I just had this overwhelming feeling that I was never going to see her alive again.
A massive police presence converged on the inner city community of El Tidor as volunteers searched alongside officers. The following day, their worst fears were confirmed. A couple helping out with the search found Kimmy's body.
Can't tell you the amount of pressure it put on me and my superiors. What's going on? And have you done this? Have you done that? And as we know, investigating a homicide is a slow process. There's no shortcuts.
Police were on the hunt for a killer. And at the same time, a serial rapist was eluding police.
I left these little girls with my card, my business card, and I said, we're getting really close to finding this guy. You might see him around. And I do remember telling them that if you could keep your eyes peeled, and if you see him, phone me, and here's my card.
I'm Nancy Hickst, a senior crime reporter for Global News. Today, on Crime Beat, I share how one brave little girl helped police solve two major crimes investigations. This is part two of The Hunt for a Predator. Before I begin, a warning. This story includes graphic details of sexual assaults and violence against children. In 1980, Kimmy Thompson's homicide investigation consumed most of Detective Daryl Wilson's waking hours. Every day the killer remained free strengthened his resolve to catch him. Over the years, I've done several interviews with Detective Wilson. For this episode, I met him in the inner city neighborhood of El Tidor, where this investigation unfolded.
It still brings back memories.
Detective Wilson spent many days walking these streets and knocking on doors. He took me through each key location.
Yeah, this corner here was the home that Kimmy lived in, and it's not there any longer. But and it had a side door, which she would leave in the morning and walk straight down 19th Street. So they had a visual on her for about a block. Down the street here.
Present-day El Tidor is a mix of new, high-end infills, million-dollar homes, and then many original older bungalows from the 1950s. In 1980, when Kimmy was killed, most of the original homes still existed. Back then, there were no CCTV or doorbell cameras. Detective Wilson can't help but wonder how different the investigation might have been if it happened now.
Would have been resolved within a day or two, I'm sure.
He said in the days following Kimmy's death, investigators walked the route she would have taken. They searched for any clues that could lead them to a suspect.
There was no footprints. In fact, if I remember correctly, there had been a fresh snow. the culprit in this case had backtracked after he got home and made sure there wasn't any.
They had multiple scenes to examine and gather forensic evidence. That included the garbage stand where Kimmy's body was found, the autopsy where police said they gathered a lot of hair and fibers, and then the garbage where they found her clothing a few days later. All of the forensic evidence gathered was sent away to the RCMP crime lab in Edmonton. And slowly, police received results.
There was no DNA, of course. Human hair was certainly helpful if you had a collection from the right person. But we didn't have that, of course, at that time.
While testing was a lot more primitive in 1980, it did prove to be helpful.
They definitely could tell us it was dog. And they definitely could tell us that there was many carpet fibers, as well, along with towels or blankets, fibers from things like that as well that we found. Something more the color of like a German Shepherd, where each hair follicle is maybe got some different colors in it. It's not a solid color and not white for sure. So we could rule out any white dogs right away.
Detective Wilson and his partner came up with a cutting edge strategy. They would track down Kimmy's killer by finding his dog.
We knew that she lived in the area that the body was found. So we felt that probably we're looking for a suspect that lives in that area as well. So my partner and I decided that we're going to start our own campaign and get some help from time to time and just concentrate on homes with dogs. So we set out on that, and day after day after day doing this, knocking on doors. And we would ask them about the case. We would tell them why we're there, but we didn't bother to tell them that we were taking hair from their dogs.
As they knocked on doors, the detective made sure to pet any dogs they encountered, and then they put the fur they managed to grab into their pockets until they left each home.
We had canisters, small round canisters that we would then put that in and mark it when we got outside to make sure we knew where it came from.
It was a slow and tedious process. The samples took months to collect, and then each one had to be sent away for testing. But they persisted and hoped this strategy would lead them to Kimmy's killer. As the investigation continued, Kimberly Thompson's family struggled to grieve, knowing the person responsible was still on the loose. Her mother said she looked at every person she passed on the street and always wondered if she came across the killer.
It wasn't just our family, it was the whole neighborhood that was in fear.
That fear grew when nearly 5 months after Kimmy's murder, two little girls out riding their bikes were attacked. You'll remember in the last episode, I shared how a 10-year-old and 11-year-old were violently taken into some bushes and sexually assaulted. They were blindfolded when they were attacked, but both got a good look at the man responsible. Their attacker used a knife to scare them and threatened to kill them. The girls reported their assaults to police, who had already been on the hunt for a serial rapist. At that point, they hadn't considered a connection between that case and the murder of Kimmy Thompson.
Yeah, there was the Southwest rapist. Everybody had heard about him, but it was about the older women. It was on the news when things happened. Yeah, but I never thought it would be a young child.
Then, one very brave little girl changed the direction of the entire investigation.
If you're looking for a smoking gun, I can absolutely guarantee you will not find it.
In October 2001, a series of letters filled with a deadly powder called anthrax were dropped into the U.S. mail system. What started as an unprecedented case turned into an unsettling mystery. Who sent these deadly letters, and why? From Campside Media and Sony Music Entertainment, I'm Josh Dean, and this is Cover Up Season 4, The Anthrax Threat, available now.
You'll recall Detective Jack Mullins of the Calgary Police Sex Crimes Unit was amazed at the description the girls were able to provide and predicted they would one day come across the offender. His prediction came true 6 days after the attack and not far from where it all happened. One of the little girls was out with her mother.
She spotted him down in the Mission District, Elbow Drive area. And she said, "I got to get over and phone Detective Mullins. I got his card." So her mother drove over to the Holy Cross Hospital, which is not far away. Out come the commissioner, and he's doing his job. "You're not parking here. Nobody parks here. You can't. I got to phone Detective Mullins." It was kind of a funny scenario, but boy, she was determined.
You have to remember, in 1980, there were no cell phones, so finding a phone to call police was a challenge. Detective Mullen said her persistence cracked the case wide open.
"And you know, you couldn't have got a better identification. I mean, there he is right there in life, the same guy that had attacked her earlier. We hustled a couple of blue and white police cars over there and got him right away."
The suspect was Harold Smeltzer. He was arrested, then taken to police headquarters in downtown Calgary. Sex crimes detective Terry Coleman questioned Smeltzer when he arrived.
"And we put him straight into an interview room. And we'd offered him the, you know, you can have a lawyer and all that sort of stuff. He'd turned it down."
Smeltzer lived with his parents in Altidore. The 24-year-old had a relatively minor history with police, with 6 prior convictions relating to property crime and theft. He was unemployed and had a limited education. He said he had only finished up to grade 8 in school. He told Detective Coleman he liked to watch a soap opera on TV every day at 3:30.
"So we started very low and got all the things that make him feel comfortable. And slowly, and I couldn't tell you how many hours it was, but there was people outside, police officers outside, wondering who this guy was. But we kept it ourselves because we'd created a connection with him."
Smeltzer also shared with the officer that he liked to go for walks and play sports, including soccer and baseball. When the detective asked if he went for a walk in the park the previous Wednesday, where he met a couple of girls, he said no. But Detective Coleman pushed. He told Smeltzer, "We have a problem. You have been identified for rape last Wednesday." Still, Smeltzer denied any involvement and told the officer, "Sorry, can't help you." Detective Coleman's partner then took a turn and asked a few questions. Still, Smeltzer denied any involvement. That's when the officers asked him to stand in the corner of the room so they could take a few Polaroid photos of him. The two sex crimes detectives left Smeltzer alone in the room with police officers guarding the door. A little over an hour later, they resumed their questioning. They told Smeltzer the second girl who was sexually assaulted the week before was shown his photo and identified him as her attacker. Detective Coleman said Smeltzer sat there for a little while, and then his eyes started blinking rapidly. He sat forward, put his elbows on the table, and his head in his hands. He told officers he would be honest with them, but wanted to know if he would get a separate cell in jail. He stated he wanted to be by himself if he went into custody. The detectives didn't make any promises, but said that would be likely. A few minutes later, he confessed to the violent attack on the two little girls. He said he was out for a walk when he saw them on their bikes. He told detectives he grabbed the oldest girl and threatened to kill them if they didn't comply with his orders. Smeltzer went into graphic detail about each of the assaults, just as the two girls had described to investigators. The detectives asked him to write his confession down, but he told them he had issues spelling and asked them to write it down for him. Detective Coleman got out a blank piece of paper, and once again, Harold Smeltzer recounted the violent attacks in detail. When he finished, the detective read the statement back to Smeltzer, and then he, along with the officers, signed the bottom.
And I said, would you take us to where that happened? And I said, because that'd be very helpful and things like that. And he said, yes. So my partner went out the door like, well, so before he changed his mind. And we got forensics follow us with the cameras. So we got out of the car and I was talking to him. And I said, now show us where it was. And he pointed out the place. So we got out of the car and I said, can you tell us where it's doing? And all the time they're taking cameras, right, for evidence. So we got that one, well, nailed down.
Detective Coleman and his partner asked Smeltzer if there were other crimes he committed.
And he started telling you there was many and many.
Harold Smeltzer admitted to being a serial rapist.
Well, we did drive him around to identify a whole bunch more. And when you see those on the charge list, those are the ones that he showed us.
According to Detective Coleman, Smeltzer said, you can get all your files because they're all mine.
He was just not one nonchalant. If that's the right word, it might not be quite the right word, but he was not in a big panic. He didn't shout at us. Was there any more? And then he started rattling them off. He knew where they were. He pointed them out, and then we'd check it with the files. He was right.
Given the detailed confessions and the age range Smeltzer admitted to victimizing, sex crimes detectives turned the case over to the homicide unit and Detective Daryl Wilson, who had been investigating the murder of 5-year-old Kimmy Thompson for the past 5 months.
So I was in the homicide office, and we were spoken to by Detective Coleman and his partner. And they told us briefly what they had, what the case was about. And so my partner and I went to the people in the door where the suspect was sitting, and we both looked at each other and said, we got our guy here, we're pretty sure. And so that was the first time I had ever heard of him.
Detective Wilson said Smeltzer's hair color matched the human hair samples they had collected. And he lived just a couple blocks from Kimmy.
He was fairly relaxed until we actually, it was my partner that finally said to him, Harold, we need to talk about Kimberly. And at that time, he started to get some tears. And so, again, it reassured us that we probably had the right guy. He got very quiet, didn't say much for a while. So we just let him think about it a little bit.
Just moments later,
he fully confessed. And this is another interesting thing about him. When he talked to you about crimes that he had committed, he was very meticulous and didn't want to miss any points. If you tried to say, well, what about this? He'd say, I'll get to that, but I want to make sure I tell you this first. He was, for a person that was, like I say, not well educated, he was, when it come to crimes, he seemed to be meticulous about it.
Harold Smeltzer provided chilling details of Kimmy Thompson's murder.
What he said is that he had set out to go to the grocery store. There was a corner store not too far from, it was in Altador, not too far from where they lived. And he really enjoyed pop beverages. And so he decided he wanted to go get some pop in the morning. And when he set out, he realized, I don't have any money and I don't have any bottle returns, so I can't get the pop. But about the same time, he sees Kimberly Thompson, and she's dawdling along playing in the snow. And so he just watched her for a while and decided that what his words were is, I'd like to have sex with her. So he followed her for a while until she got to a spot where he felt that it would be easy enough to just pick her up and carry her up the back alley to his own house. And so that's what he did.
He told police that when he picked her up, Kimmy started to yell. She told him she would be late for school. Smeltzer said he needed her to be quiet, so he told her he would drive her to school. He said she stopped yelling. He took her hand and walked her to his backyard.
So he took her in the house and asked her to undress. Told her again that he was going to have sex with her. He said he didn't think she understood that. This was in the living room. He took her into his parents' bedroom and laid her on the bed. And all of a sudden, he just said he just couldn't go through with it. But we still don't know why, what actually stopped him. He decided that he couldn't do it. They went back out to the living room. And now he's in a panic because she knows where he lives and may have seen him playing soccer with the neighborhood kids.
While Smeltzer contemplated what to do, Kimmy played with his dog, Mitzi. He described the family pet as having medium-length brown hair and said she shed a lot.
We had the right dog hair in our office. We had collected dog hair, and it just hadn't been sent to the lab yet. So eventually, I think the lab was able to tell us that out of all the dog hair samples we collected, there was four that we needed to take a look at, and the Smeltzer dog was one of them. So we would have eventually been led there, for sure.
I need to warn you again, these details are extremely disturbing. Smeltzer continued his confession and provided graphic detail on how he killed Kimberly Thompson. He told the detectives he decided to drown Kimmy in a bathtub.
When Harold is in a panic and decides he has to get rid of the body, he finally decides on, well, I'm going to take the garbage bag, put it into my little red wagon that he'd had for years, covered it up with a blanket, and keep in mind this is January, there's quite a bit of snow, and he pulls it out from the side of the home, out to Front Street, and then eventually makes his way down 18th Street to the corner of 42nd Avenue. When he reaches the corner of 42nd Avenue, he makes a right turn and goes to 19th Street and then heads south on 19th Street from there until he eventually gets it to the place where she was found.
After he confessed, detectives took Smeltzer back to Altador, where he again confessed as he walked them through the child's murder. Smeltzer told them he was careful to cover his tracks.
He just went along and brushed, instead of leaving a footprint, he just went along and brushed fresher snow over top of any footprints that were found there.
Smeltzer also admitted to being the one who called the grocery store after dumping her clothing in the back alley.
We later learned from Harold Smeltzer that he was trying to relieve the pressure here by, okay, let's give them what they want and maybe that'll appease them for a while. So that was his idea of giving up the clothing.
When he finished, he said, "That's the full story. That's it. Shall I go over it again so you can write it down?"
So it was actually, we felt good and relieved that we had caught the culprit for such an awful crime. But it's also hard to control yourself because you don't really want to be nice to this guy and you're trying to be nice to get the information from him. So it's tough for sure, yeah.
Harold Smeltzer was charged with the first-degree murder of Kimmy Thompson, as well as a string of sex crimes related to the Southwest Calgary rapist.
He stayed fairly close to home. All of the sex crimes that he committed, to the best of my knowledge, were in the southwest area of the city to start with. And a lot of them within walking distance, because he did walk a lot. He either walked or rode a bicycle.
In putting together this podcast, Detective Wilson walked me through the same Altador streets he walked over 40 years ago. He's still haunted by the horrific crime all this time later.
I'll never forget it. You know, like I said, I got children my own, similar age. It was a difficult case. Till the day I die, I'll never forget.
Kimmy Thompson's mother, Evelyn, told me she found it hard to believe they lived alongside a predator and a killer. Someone who her children had seen in the community on many occasions.
My son came to me in tears and he said, "Mommy, don't be mad at me." And I looked at him and I said, "Why would I be mad at you?" He says, "Because we played football with him." You know, I said, "I'm not mad at you. You didn't know." But yeah, when he came to me and just crying, it's like, what do you do? And that's what he did. He hung around the kids in the neighborhood.
In the spring of 1981, Harold Smeltzer stood trial in front of a jury. He pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity. His defense argued he wasn't able to think of the consequences of his actions. Detective Darrell Wilson said that's not how he came across in his interviews.
I would describe him as a loner. I would describe him as poorly educated. Didn't want to write anything himself because he didn't know how to spell words. So both the sex crimes detectives and my partner and I did all the writing for him when he did give statements. We did all the writing for him. He was unemployed. I don't think he'd ever worked that much in his life. His parents sort of looked after him.
Detective Wilson said in Smeltzer's confessions and recounting of what he did at each crime scene, it was clear he knew what he was doing. The jury agreed. It took them only an hour to convict Harold Smeltzer of first-degree murder. Following the verdict, Smeltzer pleaded guilty to two counts of rape of the two little girls he grabbed off their bikes. He also pleaded guilty to two counts of attempted rape, acts of gross indecency, break and enter, and commit attempted rape and possession of a weapon or imitation weapon. Later that year, a reward of approximately $35,000 was given to the little girl who identified Smeltzer, days after he sexually assaulted her and her friend.
I really feel sorry for those girls. And the one girl who recognized him and told her mom and they turned him in, years later, she contacted my daughter, I think it was, and said how bad she felt that she got the money for the reward. And I said, "Oh God, you know, don't." And I guess she said she just blew it. She didn't. It's like, you deserve it. You know, don't. You deserve it.
Smeltzer was sentenced to life in prison with no chance of parole for 25 years for the murder of Kimberly Thompson. He received added time for the sexual assault cases to be served concurrently.
The other thing I felt about Harold is that I didn't think that he was the sort of person you could rehabilitate. He had done these sex crimes over and over and over again, eventually committed a murder as well, but he just never impressed me as a person that could be rehabilitated.
Evelyn Thompson took solace in knowing Smeltzer would spend the rest of his life in jail.
I was hoping he would never get out. I prayed that he'd never get out.
Not a day goes by that Evelyn doesn't think of her youngest daughter.
I just wonder what she would be like today.
By now, Kimmy would have been nearly 50 years old, and Evelyn can't help but think of all the milestones they've missed celebrating.
Her graduation from kindergarten, graduation from elementary, junior high, high school, you know, would she have gone on to college? She'd gotten married. How many kids would she have had?
Losing Kimmy changed everything for her.
It was awful. It is awful. And you never get over it. I mean, you learn to live around it, but you never get over it.
It was hard to let her other two kids be kids.
They kind of lived in a prison for years till they were almost into their teens. They couldn't be alone. I just had this overwhelming fear. When my kids, my grandkids are out of my sight, it's like...
This is where I would normally end an episode of Crime Beat. And Evelyn and the other victims wish the horrific memories and fear could be in the past. Harold Smeltzer was sentenced to life in prison. And you might think his victims would never have to see or think of him ever again. But that's not what happened. 28 years after he kidnapped and murdered Kimmy, the terror all came flooding back when Smeltzer asked for parole and got it.
I found out that he gets out on day parole. He gets a second chance at life, or my baby doesn't.
Smeltzer was convicted of 5 sex offenses and the first-degree murder of Kimmy Thompson. But according to documents obtained by Global News from the Parole Board of Canada, while in prison, Smeltzer admitted that between 1975 and 1980, before he was arrested, he committed other offenses against more than 40 other victims under the age of 13. That's why, in 2008, when he was granted release, Kimmy's family made a plea for those victims to come forward. At that time, Calgary police confirmed they would investigate.
We'd be remiss not to look into those claims. As you mentioned, the number of 40 certainly is very concerning.
But no new charges have ever been laid against Smeltzer. And over the years, his freedoms have been increased.
The mom of a young Calgary girl abducted and killed more than 25 years ago is speaking out tonight. She's furious the man who killed her daughter has been granted a weekend pass. Nancy Hicks has been covering this story, and Nancy, Harold Smeltzer is now out on his first overnight pass.
Harold Smeltzer is allowed to leave his halfway house in Regina tonight and stay in an approved home for the entire weekend, beginning tonight until Sunday evening. Smeltzer has been convicted of first-degree murder. Tonight, Kimmy Thompson's family is beside themselves, concerned with the expanded freedoms.
It makes me sick, actually. Sick to my stomach, because I'm so afraid that it's going to happen again to somebody else. And nobody should have to go through what our family's gone through.
In 2017, 37 years after killing Kimmy, parole board documents revealed Smeltzer continued to struggle with sexual deviancy. The board said, "You admitted to an incident in which, while in the community, you became attracted to an underage girl who was walking down the street towards you. You were able to identify that this may have been triggered by a sex scene you had watched on television before signing out of the correctional center." Harold Smeltzer will remain on parole for the rest of his life. His freedoms continue to be expanded, and he's being transitioned from a halfway house in Saskatchewan to independent living in his own home. Over the years, Kimmy's family has tried to push for a change in the law, so offenders like Smeltzer, who have been sentenced to life in prison, would never be eligible for parole. But that law has never been passed. In a March 2023 decision, the parole board indicated Smeltzer is considered a low to moderate risk to reoffend and concluded the risk was manageable in the community. Despite this, his victims, their families, and those who caught him in the first place have told me they remain fearful of him, and they believe he'll reoffend.
And that's why I'm here today. I want people to remember Kimberly Thompson, and I also want people to remember this offender. And don't forget about him, because like I say, I do feel unless he gets too old, he's going to reoffend.
In my opinion, life should mean life, and especially when you kill a child who's innocent and they can't protect themselves.
I want to thank Evelyn for helping me share Kimmy's story. I also want to thank the other victims who spoke to me as I was putting these episodes together. And thank you to Detective Wilson, Detective Coleman, and Detective Mullins for their help in sharing this story. Crime Beat is written and produced by me, Nancy Hixt, with producer Dila Velasquez. Audio editing and sound design is by Rob Johnston. Special thanks to photographer-editor Danny Lantella for his work on this episode, and Jesse Weisner, our Crime Beat production assistant. Thank you to Chris Bassett, the VP of Network Content, Production and Distribution and Editorial Standards for Global News. I would love to have you tell a friend about this podcast. There are 5 seasons of stories you can listen to and share. And if you can, please consider rating and reviewing Crime Beat on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can find me on Facebook at Nancy Hixt Crime Beat and on Instagram at nancy.hixt. Thanks again for listening. Please join me next time.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his 6-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his 2-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.